Hello, everyone. This is Cherry Hill with CASC. And our primary topic for the day is palliative care, particularly provided in rural areas. And let me just go through the agenda first. We'll give a very brief CASC update, give you a little bit of update on our Flex conference this summer. Steve is going to be with us to talk about the Office of Rural Health Policy. Michelle Goodman will be here to talk about regulatory changes with Flex program, critical access hospitals, et cetera. John Gale will follow with an update from the Flex monitoring team, and then we're going to have several speakers talk about rural hospice and palliative care. Ann Holliday, for example, is a nursing home administrator from Muncie Valley Hospital Skilled Nursing Unit in Pennsylvania. And Dr. Karen Brown from Muncie Valley Hospital will look at palliative care 101. This is an issue that we've had a lot of questions about and seemingly a lot of interest from our state Flex programs. For our speakers on the call, what I can tell you is that the folks that are on this call basically represent 45 state Flex programs, kind of the universities of North Carolina, Minnesota, and Southern Maine, as well as the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. That's our primary audience. We also are going to look at the Veterans Hospice and Palliative Care Program that our organization has been a part of, and we're going to have some folks from VISN 23 Veterans Administration talking about this partnership, which is actually building a bridge between the Veterans Administration and their palliative care programs and community programs in various parts of that VISN region. So, kind of with that, Tracy, I'm going to ask you to provide a few of the updates from TASC, and then we'll move into our agenda. Welcome, everybody.
Sure. Thanks, Terry. So a few quick updates. Next week on the 15th, TASC will be holding a health information technology webinar on HIT network development. And so if you are interested in participating in that webinar but have not yet communicated that to us, please email Nicole Clement, and she will send you the registration information. You need to have you need to be registered for the webinar in order to participate. However, that webinar will be recorded and posted on our website as well for you to listen to the recording or to share with your hospitals or clinics or other partners that you feel could benefit from the call. That call is at from 2 until 3:30 p.m. Central Time on the 15th. Another thing, an important thing to tell you about is the upcoming 2011 National Conference of the State Flex Programs. The conference will be July 12th and 13th in Portland, Maine. And right now we're working with the Office of Rural Health Policy and our planning committee to develop a great agenda, putting that together and adding in speakers. We did send an email to you all asking for your speaker or topic suggestions. So if you have something to share, please do email Nicole as well. Online registration we anticipate being available in April through the TASC website, and we'll communicate that to you. The conference will be similar in format to last year, with plenary sessions and then small group sessions with states sharing their stories with one another, and plenty of time to network. And also, the audience will be similar to last year as well, with two participants per state, and those being State Office of Rural Health Directors, Flex Coordinators, or other key Flex personnel.
Just one other thing to share as well is that in December, we convened a meeting of about 20 people representing state offices of rural health and state Flex programs. There were some representatives of hospital associations, critical access hospitals themselves, and then some of the key consultants that have been doing work on quality improvement and performance improvement in our critical access hospitals. It was a two-day session, and we asked the participants to come kind of with a list of what are the things that you've learned, you know, Darlene Bainbridge, for example, and a variety of other people who have worked closely with critical access hospitals, you know, and Dave Palm, for example, from the Flex program in Nebraska, and We were really very, very pleased that the group came to a fairly good consensus on kind of the most important things they've learned over the years and things that they could share with the state flex programs. We have put together a number of documents to kind of help share these lessons learned with our state flex programs. And in that regard, we'll have a very brief manual that will be available, kind of a composite of all of the things that we heard. And again, I was frankly amazed at how much agreement there was on recommended approaches, how to sustain performance improvement in hospitals, kind of how to work with the boards, how to enlist physicians, et cetera, et cetera. So that is going to be coming out next month. It'll be coming out from TASC. And again, I think there's some really good things in there, and I'm really excited about sharing that with all of you. A second product is an article that we intend to have published, and that's in draft stage at this moment as well. And then the third piece is basically a PowerPoint presentation that we will, again, share with all of you. And if there's pieces of it or all of it that would provide value, please feel free to use it. But it's a product that you can expect in March, well, products actually in March. And, again, I want to thank the approximately 20 kind of quality improvement experts, gurus, et cetera, that showed up in Minneapolis and helped us kind of design these materials. With that, is there any questions? Anybody have any questions to TASC? You can ask them quickly now or do email us. Do hold us to our standard. If you contact us, our standard is getting back to you within 24 hours. We don't always have the answer at hand, but we'll acknowledge your question, and we've really tried to keep that 24 hours as kind of a gold standard, and I'm probably the only one who screws up occasionally, so I apologize in advance if you don't always get that kind of response from me, but the rest of our crew here works really hard to make that happen. One other thing that we've done, kind of to systematize our technical systems a little bit more, is we've created key informant groups in all of the key areas of the FLEX program. And that basically is going to be a sounding board for your questions, for our questions, et cetera. So when you have questions, we have an ability now to send it out to maybe a dozen different experts. Just last week, for example, our critical access hospital finance group got together. And again, these are probably the 8 or 9 people that we most, that we know about, that does a great job on this, the people that we go to anyway. Now we've created a more systematic way of getting multiple responses and ensuring that the quality of our technical assistance is as good as it can possibly be. So again, we're creating these virtual groups. We've got a virtual finance group and a quality group, an EMS key informant group. What am I missing here?
HIT
and telehealth group. These are key informants, and then, as you know, we're going to really launch our cohorts of state flex programs as well. So a lot of networks, a lot of things happening here at TASC. If Steve is with us, Steve, I'm going to invite you to provide an update from the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy.
And it's *#* to unmute your line.
Yeah, *#* to unmute your line.
There, I think I've got it unmuted.
Great.
Yeah, we can hear you, Steve.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, hello, everybody. Glad to be here. I hope everyone's enjoying better weather than we're having here in D.C., where it's rather cold, at least for D.C. it is. Not sure about compared to Duluth. We have a few things to talk about from the Office of Rural Health Policy. There haven't been any big changes here. I will point out that we don't have a budget. Some of you are probably familiar with that. We are operating on a continuing resolution until the beginning of March, at which time either Congress will have to pass a budget or another continuing resolution to keep us operating. We assume that the budget the way we're operating is under a budget similar to last year's budget. That may not turn out to be true in the end if Congress decides to make changes, but we'll have to just wait and see. In the meantime, I will update you on a couple things here, one of which is, of course, some of you have heard this, that the Flex PIMS system for reporting data from the grantees to us, there's a reporting tool that outputs the data that you put in, and that was the problem that we had a call about last month, as it turned out. In some states' cases where you were entering data for both third-party contracts and for direct awards, it was multiplying some of the amounts when it reported the data out, and that was the problem. And they're still working on fixing that and may have it done in a day or two. Hopefully then we'll have real clean data. It appears that people put in correct data, and the problem was in the software. Some other things I'll mention: that NOSOR is having a webinar on rural health clinics, it's a virtual conference, a mix of online webinars and group discussions. Be sure to look at the NOSOR website. You can find out more about that. CMS is having a Rural Health Open Door Forum on March 8th, which is a Tuesday at 2 o'clock Eastern Time. If you don't have info on that, we can send it out, but I hope you do. And I want to ask the Flex coordinators, we are still have not gotten all the updated financial reports, FFRs. If you're having trouble, and I hear some states are having trouble with getting into the EHB or doing your FFR, please contact your project officer and let us know. If you're having trouble getting a response from grants management, your grant specialist about any problems they have with your FFRs, again, please contact your project officer so that we can help out with that. And that's all I've got right now. I'll pass it back to Terry or...
Is Michelle with us? Could Michelle kind of proceed from here with her update on the critical access hospital regulatory changes?
Hi, this is Michelle. Hope that you can hear me.
Hi, Michelle. We can hear you.
Okay, good. Glad I was able to unmute this correctly this time. So I had just a couple of things that I wanted to bring to your attention, and I did provide slides to Nicole this time, and unfortunately I didn't get them to her. They didn't get cleared quickly enough for them to go out with the email yesterday, but she will be sending those out when she sends the recording information, so I apologize for that. The first thing that I wanted to bring you all, let you all know about, are that on January 24th, CMS announced new rules authorized under the Affordable Care Act, which will help CMS to really curtail and help to stop healthcare fraud by providing CMS with a number of different types of authority to impose new provider screening and enforcement measures for certain what they call high-risk providers and supplier types. It also does some of those new screening procedures would be things like fingerprinting and background checks, and this would be for certain types of providers and certain types of supplier types. This also gave CMS the authority to suspend payments to a provider or supplier type when there is a credible allegation of fraud is being investigated. And it does include application fees that are being imposed to institutional providers and suppliers, which do include CAHS, RHCs, FQHCs, all the different types of provider and supplier types that work, that bill under Medicare. The application fee for 2010 2010, this is supposed to be in 2010, was $500. For 2011 and for subsequent years, it will be adjusted by the percentage change in the consumer price index. So I think it went up just a few dollars in 2011. There is a, you can request a hardship exception to the application fee that is available, and there is information on this on about the hardship application at the in the regulation. The other thing that it does do is it provides so what Medicare and state agencies are going to be looking at trends that indicate that there is some healthcare fraud. And if there is a trend that is identified in a category of a provider or in a geographic area, this regulation did give CMS the authority to temporarily stop enrollments, to create a temporary moratorium for enrollment of new providers and supplier types, as long as that would not impact access to care for patients. None of the moratorium is not going in place at the moment. It's just in case that there is an issue, they have the authority to do that. And as I said, all of this was within the Affordable Care Act, and you can look at the regulation, which in the PowerPoint will provide the link to that to the regulation. Another thing that you've all probably been hearing a lot about is the proposed rule that was published on January 13th on the Hospital Inpatient Value-Based Purchasing Program. This rule was designated to implement Section 3001 of the Affordable Care Act, which required CMS to establish a new hospital value-based purchasing program to reward hospitals that are providing high quality and safe care to patients. This program was for inpatient PPS hospitals only, for those subsection D hospitals. However, that legislation within that section 3001 of the Affordable Care Act, it did include two demonstration projects, one for to test of value-based purchasing models for critical access hospitals, and another one for small PPS hospitals that do not qualify for the value-based purchasing program because of their low numbers. Those two demonstration projects are supposed to start or be implemented by March 23rd of 2012. So hopefully we'll start hearing more about those two demonstration programs. And the secretary must submit a report to Congress on that demonstration in 2016. So although this demonstration that was just brought, the proposed reg just came out, was only for inpatient hospitals, inpatient PPS hospitals, we're hoping that we can see very soon something similar, a demonstration program for those cause. If you are interested, CMS is going to be holding a special open door forum tomorrow, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 Eastern Time to talk about the proposed hospital inpatient VBP rule. And what I forgot to say was that program would start for hospitals, for those PPS hospitals, October 1st of 2012. The last thing that I wanted to bring you all was a CMS sent out a advanced notice of proposed rulemaking to look at soliciting comments on the need to address two policies concerning the applicability of the EMTALA rules. This would be for hospital inpatients and the responsibilities that the hospitals have with specialized capabilities. So CMS is requesting comments on specific real-world examples that demonstrate whether or it would be beneficial for them to revisit the policies, the EMTALA policies that they articulated in their final rule that they proposed in 2003. And another one that they some other EMTALA rules that they published in the inpatient PPS final rule in 2008. Comments are due on this February 22nd, 2011. And so really what they're asking for are commenters aware of situations where an individual who presented under EMTALA with an unstable emergency medical condition was admitted to the hospital where he or she first presented and was then transferred to another facility, even though the admitting hospital had the capacity and capability to treat the individual's emergency medical condition? And was there any accuracy in CMS's statement in their August 2008 inpatient rule that hospital with specialized capabilities would accept the transfer of an inpatient with an unstabilized emergency medical condition absent of an EMTALA obligation? So I think this is something that you all may want to go back and read. I do provide in the presentation a link to the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. So if you want to go back, think it over, see how these things have worked, let the cause know about this, and comments must be received by February 22nd. And just wanted to let you all know we're here for you all. If you have questions, please feel free to contact us. We have, as I said previously, we have a number of different people on our policy team now who have lots of different specialties, so just feel free to pick up the phone or email us with your questions. That was it.
Are there any questions for Michelle? Just a bit of an update then. Obviously, with the changes that are going on after the recent election, there's been some concern about kind of the future of the FLEX program and rural health programs, et cetera. And as probably everybody knows, there have been a good bit of discussion about programs to cut, et cetera. And when the Heritage Foundation, kind of a very influential kind of conservative foundation, came up with recommendations, it appeared at least, I can't remember if it's explicit or not, that there were a lot of rural health cuts that would be included in the Heritage Foundation's recommendations. And I think we were all a little concerned about that, how that would kind of play out, because that foundation has been very influential with a lot of particularly conservative Republicans as such. We had a discussion of our task advisory committee this morning, and both John Suplett and Brock Slabaugh, John Suplett, who is with the head of the rural hospital section, the American Hospital Association, and Brock Slabaugh with the National Rural Health Association, kind of provided us some updates on what is going on, et cetera. So there didn't appear to be anything of any immediate threat at the moment, but I think we've all pretty much concluded that it's, you know, the more that we can do to document the effectiveness of the FLEX program, the better. We need to be able to give enough ammunition, for example, to the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy so that they can show value for all of the programs, particularly the FLEX program, at least applicable for this call. The National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health are orchestrating a collection of information, value, et cetera. So we have been working closely with Terrell Eisinger and NOSOR and NRHA, et cetera. Just want to let you know that. We can't be an advocacy organization because of our role here, but we work in support to try to get information, education out to folks that can be more overt in their advocacy. We also just got word, which I think is very good news here, and this is actually only minutes old from what I can see, from Terrell Eisinger, that Bill Finnefrock had sent an email out saying that the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee issued a press release identifying the non-defense discretionary program cuts that they're proposing, and it appears that the FLEX, Outreach, and other HRSA rural programs have avoided the cuts. So that's extremely good news. In other words, what we're hearing, at least, and again, we haven't even had the time to check this out, but I'm pretty good sources in Terrell and Bill Finnefrark of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics is that the chair of the Appropriations Committee is not looking to rural health cuts, at least in this proclamation. So that I don't think that that's a cause for any of us to get complacent, but at the same time, it's good news because it doesn't appear that particularly our favorite program is on the chopping block at this point. So that's kind of a latest update. I think that just happened today, so we'll see where that goes, and we'll keep you more fully informed with that. I want to turn things over now to John Gale, who's with the University of Southern Maine, and most of you know John. He's been a long time part of our Flex monitoring team, and John's going to give an update on what's happening in the Flex monitoring programs. John, are you with us?
Just a reminder, John, if you're with us and your line is muted, please press *, and you should be able to unmute your line that way.
Hey, Terry, this is Catherine Miller. While we're waiting, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, sure can. We may be waiting a long time here, too, Catherine.
Oh, okay. It'll be a short one, though. The NOSOR RHC webinar that someone mentioned, where do I find information on that?
Webinar?
The RHC webinar? We will track it down and send it to you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Is John on yet from the Flex monitoring team? Well, let's try to remember what we had a Flex monitoring team update, as I recall. Let's see if we can remember what at our advisory committee today. Basically, go ahead.
Well, one project that they're working on is looking at some of the quality indicators and reviewing both national programs and state programs for evidence-based practices and improvement of quality within four core areas: congestive heart failure, pneumonia, surgical site infection, and one other. I'm doing this from the top of my head here, so I apologize.
Pretty good.
And so I know that they're in the process right now of reviewing all the national programs for evidence-based best practices, and then are just now starting to follow up with some of the states that they know have programs out there to collect more information. So you may be hearing from the Flex monitoring team regarding that if you haven't already.
And that's my understanding is that the MIBQIP program is going to be done kind of in harmony with that. There have been a number of initiatives over the years to generate critical access hospital-specific quality indicators, and I think what the monitoring team is doing is taking a really good look at what is out there. Is there a possibility of kind of aggregating them, et cetera? This has been a topic for quite some time. A few years ago, CMS, I don't know if many of you know this, but CMS had commissioned a study to create separate quality indicators for critical access hospitals. And the University of Minnesota and I think Stratus Health, and then I think it was the QIO in Utah, if I'm not mistaken, were kind of the three lead organizations, and they convened a group of folks to basically look at development of separate standards and quality indicators, and in effect, they came up with a pretty complete group of quality indicators that CMS announced that they were going to roll out shortly, but never did. So this was at least 4 or 5 years ago. So that there has been kind of a generally accepted group of quality indicators that were developed before, and I think it's kind of digging those out again, looking at which ones we can use and kind of which ones would make sense here, and then kind of cross that, walking that to the MIBQIP indicators as well. So as you guys know, the first step along the MIPCWIP path is going to be on the hospital compare side of it. And, you know, I'm not going to speak on behalf of Paul and the group, but just want to let you know that there's a lot of activity going on within the Flex monitoring team as well.
Another project that they did report this morning, too, that they're working on is the state reports about the hospital compare quality indicators that go out annually. So just like the financial indicators report, you receive a report about hospital compare quality indicators. And those are in final review stages, and it sounded like they were intending on emailing that information to the Flex coordinators by the end of this month. So look for that to come soon. And I don't know if John has had the opportunity to join us yet or not, but I think that we'll maybe just move ahead then.
Why don't we do that? Yeah, let's turn to the topic of the day, which is rural hospice and palliative care. This is one of those issues that I think has a lot of meaning for many of us. I know my own father died in hospice, and it was such a gift to have hospice available. There are kind of a number of programs throughout the country, many of them kind of affiliated with or located in critical access hospitals. And we wanted to take a look at this with a little more depth and get a feel for what the VA might be doing and what some of the other models out there that we might kind of use as models for others to look at. We've got two different programs, as I indicated, that we wanted to spotlight. Is Ann Holliday with us? I just want to make sure you're here, Ann.
We're here.
Oh, terrific. Thanks. Thank you so much for doing that. I'm going to introduce, most of you know Cammie Norlin, or at least we hope you do. She's a part of TASC, and she's been working specifically. Part of her responsibilities are working on in the area of palliative care. And I'm going to ask Cammie to introduce our speakers. Cammie, I'll turn it to you.
Yes, thank you, Terry. And thank you, everybody. I would like to introduce you to Ann Holliday. Ann is a certified nursing home administrator. She has a master's in health administration degree from the University of Scranton. And she is employed at the Muncie Hospital in Pennsylvania. And she'll be presenting on Palliative Care 101, joined with Dr. Karen Brown, who has a medical degree from Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, and she's board certified in family medicine and hospice and palliative medicine. She also practices at Muncie Hospital in Pennsylvania. And thank you, Anne and Dr. Karen Brown.
Thank you, Cammie.
Thank you
for inviting us today. Just to give you a little bit of background, the Muncie Valley Skilled Nursing Unit is a 108-bed skilled nursing unit attached to the 20-bed Muncie Valley Hospital Critical Access Hospital. Our facility has been able to incorporate palliative services into the care we provide for more than 50% of our residents in the skilled nursing unit. The palliative team also treats inpatients in the Muncie Valley Hospital, both when the patients are at an acute level of care or utilizing the swing bed services. So our goals today in the next 15 minutes are to focus on understanding what is palliative care and how does it differ from hospice care, who provides palliative care, and how palliative care helps support the care and values of rural communities and hospitals. So just what is palliative care? Palliative care is any form of medical care or treatment that concentrates on reducing the severity of disease symptoms rather than just striving to halt, delay, or reverse progression of the disease itself or to provide a cure. The goal is to prevent and relieve suffering and to improve the quality of life for people facing serious and complex illnesses. Non-hospice palliative care is not dependent on prognosis and is offered in conjunction with curative and all other appropriate forms of medical treatment. who provides palliative care. Our palliative care team is made up of a clinical nurse specialist who is a master's prepared nurse certified in hospice and palliative medicine, a nurse practitioner who is also certified in hospice and palliative medicine, as well as physicians. The basic tenets of palliative care: palliative is considered to be the model for quality, compassionate care for people facing life-limiting illness or injury. Both hospice and palliative care involve a team-oriented approach to expert medical care, pain management, and emotional and spiritual support expressly tailored to the patient's needs, wishes, and values. Support is provided to the patient's loved one as well. At the center of hospice and palliative care is the belief that each of us has the right to die pain-free and with dignity, and that our families will receive the necessary care and support to allow us to do so. So what's the difference between hospice and palliative care? Hospice focuses on the caring, not curing. And in most cases, care is provided for hospice in a patient's home. Hospice can also be provided in freestanding hospice centers, hospitals, in the nursing home, such as where I work, and other long-term care facilities. However, in order to utilize the hospice benefit, a physician must certify that a patient is in the last 6 months of life. So curative treatments for the disease or illness are halted. With palliative care, on the other hand, palliative care extends the principles of hospice to a broader population that could benefit from receiving this care earlier in their illness or disease process. No specific therapy is excluded from consideration and can be done in conjunction with curative therapies such as chemotherapy. An individual's needs must be continually assessed, and treatment options should be explored and evaluated in the context of the individual's values and symptoms. Palliative care ideally would segue as the disease progresses into hospice care. In addition, palliative care customizes treatment to meet the needs of each individual. It seeks to relieve pain, anxiety, shortness of breath, fatigue, nausea, loss of appetite, and other symptoms. Practitioners of palliative care can help families and patients understand treatment options and facilitate communication among the various healthcare professionals, patients, and family members. I use the analogies that the palliative team is like the Switzerland of medical care. Emotional and spiritual support for patients and family are the hallmarks of palliative care. So common chronic conditions treated under palliative care are advanced stages of cardiac, pulmonary, and renal disease, dementia and other neurological diseases, cancer as well. An essential practice for good palliative care is to be vigilant for those distressing symptoms that can complicate chronic conditions. For example, 80% of patients with end-stage heart failure will have pain, 63% will die with severe dyspnea, and 70% will die with depression. Palliative care is an approach to managing the chronic disease and other serious and advanced illnesses that center on the relieving of suffering and improving the quality of life for patients and families. 7 out of 10 Americans who die each year die of a chronic disease. Our healthcare services need to evolve to provide appropriate care. Rural communities are uniquely positioned to meet the challenges for providing palliative care through collaborative efforts. Rural communities with similar areas of focus can benefit from structured opportunities to connect and share tools and lessons learned in implementation. Managing a serious illness takes a village, and palliative care brings together support systems that patients, along with doctors and their families, need to determine how to best provide the best quality of life. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Karen Brown, who has some specific examples of care that we have provided palliative care services.
Hi, I'm Dr. Karen Brown, and I am team members of the palliative care team that we have in our system. I'm one of five team members. We have another physician, we have two nurse practitioners, and a clinical nurse specialist. We provide care in a lot of different avenues. We do some community outpatient consults. We do provide hospital consults at our regional medical center in our system, as well as the critical access hospital and in the nursing homes as well. For us in the critical access hospital, it's either one of the nurse practitioners or primarily me who provide the consults at the critical access hospital. But there are other places who use the clinical nurse specialist to provide that care depending on what we have for access. And we try to augment that with some of the other team members that we have because we work together with our hospice team, so we can rely on and tap some of the resources we have there in terms of using chaplain and social work support from our system there. A lot of people have concerns about how we bill for palliative care. As a consult service, we bill Medicare by the symptoms that we're treating, for example, pain or dyspnea. The attending physician bills by diagnosis, as you know, and that allows for both providers to see the patient and be able to bill for care. Palliative care consults are covered by Medicare. Most other insurances will cover palliative care referrals, although it's important to clarify that with each individual case. There are some limitations sometimes in terms of the number of visits, and there are sometimes copays required for palliative care visits. In order for us to become involved, a referral is required from the attending physician, like any other specialty care. We're designed to help with patients who have complex chronic life-limiting conditions, and Ann talked a little bit about some of those conditions. Two that I would add that we cover quite a bit are the cancer diagnoses and sometimes just failure to thrive. And in our critical access hospital, we have had several referrals for management of pain in elderly patients who have osteoporosis and have had compression fractures with intractable pain. Most of the symptoms that we cover are most frequently pain, also shortness of breath and delirium, but it can run the gamut from anything, nausea, anorexia, fatigue, anxiety, depression, even itching we've been consulted for. One patient in particular stands out was a 92-year-old lady who had end-stage CHF. She was a widow who lived alone on a farm that her family had managed for years. And she was in and out of the hospital with exacerbations of her CHF symptoms, at times very weak and short of breath. That was very anxiety-provoking for her, and we were consulted to help with symptom management and also with the planning of her care. And she talked very openly about her life and realized that she was nearing her dying time. She was very clear that she wasn't afraid of actually dying, but she was very much afraid of suffocating at the time of her death. And although she lived alone, she had strong family support in the area and very much wanted to be in her home when it was her dying time. So she was followed on palliative care in the hospital for symptom management of her shortness of breath. We worked to provide support and planning as she was transferred to the skilled nursing unit for some therapy. She was able to return back home and at that time was on hospice care. So palliative care was able to work to provide her with a continuum of care to honor her wishes across the different facilities and to ultimately allow her to die peacefully at home. We also provide community support in some cases. We not long ago had one of our physicians who met with a group of Amish people in their barn to address their questions and concerns and to try and provide this type of care to people who are less likely to use the medical system and sometimes overlooked in our medical system. And we talked a lot about the symptom management. The other big piece of palliative care is to help with advanced care planning, and that That includes discussing code status, but also goals for future care. And that's, as we all know, very important in our current healthcare environment when we're looking to reduce our hospital readmissions within 30 days and to reduce our medical costs. Many patients, particularly in rural areas, do not necessarily have written documents specifying their wishes for end of life, but they have very definite opinions often about what they want. And I recently took care of an elderly gentleman who was still running his farm into his 90s and had never actually talked to his family about his wishes for end of life, had never talked to his health care provider, and he rarely even visited his doctor until he was diagnosed with colon cancer. When we talked, I asked him how he would like us to approach his care, and he told me very emphatically that he would not want his animals to suffer, and he did not want to suffer either. So we were able to help with him in terms of providing hospice care and ultimate symptom management to ultimately get him to where he wanted to be. One of the big benefits is palliative care is that we have the luxury to talk to patients about their perception of their illness and their how that affects their lives and how they see their future as they have these chronic and often very debilitating illnesses. We'd all like to be able to do that, but the reality in our current system is that's hard to come by sometimes. But that allows us to discuss our preferences, not just the code status, not just whether to resuscitate or not, but whether patients want to be readmitted to the hospital, whether they want surgery, dialysis, antibiotics, feeding, hydration, all of that can be addressed. And as part, in conjunction with our palliative care team, we've been working actively on training staff to facilitate discussions and complete POST forms. And the POST, you might be familiar with, stands for Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And that's a form that's easily identifiable and can travel with the patients across the continuum of care from one facility to another to clearly document their wishes and improve the quality of care. Without the POST, you run the risk of a situation that we had not long ago where a nursing home resident had a DNR order in her chart, but she became acutely short of breath and went into pulmonary edema over the weekend. Her primary physician wasn't on that weekend, and her primary family contact, who knew about her wishes, was not available at the time. So the family member who was contacted, not realizing, said, well, sure, send her to the hospital, where the lady was subsequently admitted to the ICU and intubated on the ventilator. She was seen by palliative care in the hospital. We were able to respect her wishes. She was returned to the nursing home where we followed her here to provide comfort care, and she was able to die peacefully a few days later. But that's a situation that can be avoided with more extensive use of POST forms. So those are some of the things that we do try to work on to improve the quality of care for the folks here in our area.
Thank you.
Great. Karen and Ann, can you talk a little bit about what kind of obstacles and problems do you encounter as you're providing palliative care in hospice and rural areas of your service area? I mean, what are both the ones that you might encounter kind of locally and those broader that might be related to policy issues, et cetera?
Well, one of the obstacles that we have is that the attending physician, the primary care physician, often says, well, I can provide palliative care, that what I do and the orders that I give are adequate. And it's not as if Dr. Brown, she's also a family practice physician, but in all honesty, the physicians don't have the time to spend the quality time that the patients need in order to really understand what's happening and to make these decisions. The palliative team will come in and, you know, spend that half an hour or an hour with a family if that's what it takes in order to move the person forward into the decision-making process.
We've also invested a lot in education in terms of not just the medical staff and helping them understand how we can not try and step on any toes or certainly not interfere with their relationships with patients, but to help augment that. And also with the nursing staff and sometimes the administration and even community support. I can't tell you how many times I walk into a room and say, I'm the palliative care doctor, and there's a completely blank response. You know, it's an ongoing process to educate folks as to how we can help and what we can offer.
Yeah, this seems to be, you know, kind of consistent with a pretty acute shortage of physicians really trained in geriatrics. And as our population is aging, and as we need, you know, specialists in this area, we're going to come up woefully short here. So, you know, basically there's a certain skill set. There is a process that, you know, hospice professionals actually follow that really can't be short-circuited by just anybody in that regard. So thanks for sharing that. There also was some concern about reimbursement for this program, and I wonder if either of you would talk about that. I remember going to a conference years ago where one of the CPAs who was on the agenda said, you know, avoid hospice at all if it's at all possible because it's a money loser. Which made me angry because, you know, our critical access hospitals are there. Obviously, they have to keep a positive bottom line, if at all possible. But hospice just seems like such a kind of a community-driven and non, you know, profit-driven mission sort of thing. Can you tell me a little bit about, have you been able to hold your own financially from a critical access hospital financing standpoint, or is this a problem?
Well, it's always a concern, definitely, and I can tell you from the palliative care standpoint, it is a money losing. It is not a profit generating part of the system. But we also, as I said, work with a hospice that really does thrive and sometimes makes up a little bit for some of the shortfall with the palliative care. We're fortunate to have a system who really believes in what we're doing and is very supportive of that. And also, it's worth keeping in mind that it isn't, when you look at the red versus the black, just in terms of the revenue for hospice and palliative care, that's one thing, but there's a lot of data out there to show that, there's more emerging data out there now to show that hospice and palliative care are ultimately money savers down the line in terms of less readmissions and for people who didn't want readmissions. We know that the vast majority of healthcare expense comes at the end of life, and if that's not something that people really wanted, that's a way to avoid, and that impacts the bottom line also.
Which might be particularly relevant for the new accountable care organizations. And I mean, one of the things that we've been doing is try to figure out how do critical access hospitals fit into some of these new configurations. And I think your point's really very well taken. In essence, it's a way to save money while providing more compassionate care.
Right.
And as part of an ACO, which has kind of a fixed budget, et cetera, we're going to be looking for ways to provide care both more economically and more compassionately. Are there other questions from our participants? Remember, it's star pound. Any questions about any aspects? I was not totally clear about the distinction between palliative care and hospice, so I think I've learned something here in terms of a little bit more distinction. But anybody else have a question?
Yeah, this is Kenny in South Dakota.
Hey, Kenny.
Yeah, I guess my question is regarding rural in this area is, you know, you primarily spoke about chronic disease, but is there more of a chance that this service would be needed because of injury, you know, because of, you know,
sure.
the ag industries?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just the ag field, you know, it's a dangerous way of life. So,
yeah, we have often patients who have head injuries, or there's also a lot of folks we have who have had anoxic injuries from MIs or CVAs, those kind of things. there are often acute injuries that come up that play a role in this. But I've just the vast majority of what we do is more the chronic
disease management.
Right.
What about the issue of potential burnout? It seems to me such an emotional kind of intense sort of an undertaking. Does there tend to be frequent turnover of the hospice staff? Or talk a little bit about that.
I think that, you know, in different forms of medicine, whether it's long-term care, hospice and palliative, you know, the ER, whatever, certain people are called to different types of medicine. And for the hospice and palliative care team that we have very low turnover, but the people that are attracted to that type of medicine are called to it. And so, you know, it becomes their life mission, and, you know, it really, you know, gives them a purpose and really helps them live out their mission. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Dr. Brown.
Well, the team-oriented approach is key to that, too. You know, we kind of hold each other up at times. And,
yes.
You know, we do have monthly meetings. We call them First Fridays, where we just sit and we talk and we have the opportunity to just share what's on our mind and how we're doing. And there is absolutely burnout. There are times for all of us where it's difficult to do, but it is something that we feel very committed to doing and actually get a lot back from that we don't always realize.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that struck me in the experience that I had with hospice, and again, was my father who died. And it's just the extraordinary commitment of the people that kind of serve your family. So I truly, you know, if there's anything that we can do, if once you've been through that, you feel almost eternally obligated to help support the program as well. Are there other, any other questions here before we move on to our next speakers? Then I want to thank both Ann and Karen for being here. It sounds like an absolutely terrific program, and thanks for all you folks do for all the families in your service area that kind of going through this death experience. Thanks again.
Thank you for asking us.
Cami, I'll let you introduce our next speakers.
Yes, thank you. And I'd like to give a warm welcome to Kelly Schneider and Carolyn Schauer, who are both with the Veterans Administration here and the Veterans Integrated Service Network, VISN 23. We've been partnering with them on building a bridge between rural hospitals and clinics and rural providers and rural hospice organizations with VA hospice palliative care organizations. We're going to begin by listening to Kelly Schneider, who will provide an overview of the Veterans Administration and the VA Office of Rural Health. Kelly is responsible for the administrative functions of assisting 8 VA medical centers in VISN 23, and she manages existing programs and launches new long-term care program initiatives. She is responsible for strategic planning, quality oversight, and management of VA programs associated with state veterans homes, contracted community nursing homes, and VA community living centers, which is better known to us rural health folks as nursing home beds. We will then hear from Carolyn Schauer, who is the Hospice and Palliative Care Program Manager of the Veteran Integrated Service Network 23, which comprises of 8 medical facilities in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota. Prior to the VA, Carolyn worked as a program manager at a freestanding community hospice agency for 20 years. Again, I'd like to thank them. And Kelly and Carolyn, please hit star pound to unmute your lines. And there's also handouts that were sent out in the email that you can reference during their presentation.
Thank you, Cami. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Well, I first want to thank Terry and Cami and Nicole for this wonderful opportunity to share with you today about the Veterans Health Administration and about the VA Rural Health Office as well as the Hospice and Palliative Care Program in the VA and in VISN 23. So I'll get started with my slides. The one handout actually has slides, both my slides and Caroline's slides. So going on to slide two, to understand a little bit for those of you that don't know a lot about the Department of Veterans Affairs, it is actually broken out into three administrations or branches, if you will. And so there's the Veterans Health Administration, and that's what we work under, and that is the health care portion of the VA. The next is the Veterans Benefit Administration, or the VBA as we call it, and it has to do with all the benefits that are made available to veterans following their service in the military. And then lastly is the cemetery services, and there's a VA website, obviously, if you go on to slide three. This is just a snapshot picture of the VA.gov website, and the link is actually at the top of this slide. And as you can see, if you go over to the under home, right next to home, there's in the toolbar there, it says Veterans Services. And when you click on that, it actually gives you the whole laundry list of Veterans Services that are offered to veterans either in the VHA, the VA, or the cemetery services. So there's quite a lot of information in there for you to be able to look at. And then if you go on to slide four, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Veterans Health Administration. And currently we have in our country 153 VA medical centers nationwide. The VHA is actually the largest healthcare system in the United States at this point in time. And you hear a lot about the term VISN and what does that acronym actually mean. And it stands for the Veterans Integrated Service Network. And basically, it is a group or a region of VA medical centers that work under leadership at that particular regional office. So that's what the term VISN means. And our focus, obviously, is to provide accessible and quality health care to our veterans. But VHA also conducts research and education and provides emergency medical preparedness, which some people may not think about. But we have a strong research and education component to our administration. If you go on to slide five now, this is actually a picture of the United States that shows the 21 different VISNs throughout the country. And as you can see, we are in the upper Midwest there. And we are made up of the five states of North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa. But if you look at this map, you can actually see that our VISN also kind of bleeds into the surrounding states as well, such as Wisconsin, Missouri, Kansas, Wyoming. And so we have quite a large area compared to some of the other VISNs in the eastern part of the country. Going on to slide six, this gives you the list of all the VA medical centers or VA healthcare systems within VISN 23, within our VISN. And I won't read through each one of those for you, but I do want to explain why some facilities are called VA medical centers and why some VAs are facilities are called healthcare systems. And years ago, most VA facilities across the country were called VA medical centers, and at that time, they looked pretty much like community hospitals do, where there was inpatient services and also have outpatient clinics. But things have started to change over the years, and the VA recognized the need to provide greater access to veterans in those rural areas, highly rural areas of the country. So they began launching what we call community-based outpatient clinics, and the acronym for that is CBOCs. And with the addition of numerous outpatient clinics, the VA started to recognize that we've become more of a healthcare system now, and so we're starting to see the gradual change of the name of many of our VA healthcare systems. So that's the reasoning behind that name change. If you go on to slide 7, you're going to see, although this is a very busy slide, it gives you an idea of all of the both VA medical centers in our 5-state region, but which is the little stars is going to give you where our medical centers are or our healthcare systems. And then it also shows you, the little flower icon shows you the community-based outpatient clinics that are connected to various VA healthcare systems or medical centers. So, and those continue to expand and have continued to expand over the last several years. So I think our veterans are pleased to see that there are more of these outpatient clinics cropping up in the more rural areas of our state.
Hey, Kelly, could I interrupt you for just one moment, please?
Yes,
your volume is going in and out. If I could have you...
Sure.
A little bit louder, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you very much. Is that better?
Yes, that's perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. So on the next slide then is slide 8, and now I want to transition to the VA Rural Resource Centers. There was another handout that you were given that actually is the flyer for the VHA Office of Rural Health, and hopefully that'll be a good resource for you as well. But I'm going to start kind of at the facility level and work up in this presentation now. And so the rural outreach or resource centers, there's a lot of activity that really begins at the local VA medical center or VA healthcare system. And the local facilities, VA facilities, typically partner with their state's Office of Rural Health. And in some states, that may be the Department of Health and Human Services, and in others, it's through the... And going on to slide 9, I've highlighted it at the top here, the actual link that you can... the web link that you can get into the VHA Office of Rural Health. And this particular office was launched in 2006. And as you can see that the mission of this office is to improve access and quality of care for enrolled and rural, highly rural veterans by developing evidence-based policies and innovative practices and supporting the unique needs of enrolled veterans residing in geographically remote areas. But I think it goes without saying that it is also to partner with community health care providers and services in those very rural areas. And then right below that, I have the organizational structure of those that head up the office in Washington, D.C., and the names of those individuals. But I think some background information that you may or may not be aware of is that the VA has right now approximately 3 million enrolled veterans that live in the either rural or highly rural areas of our country. And out of those, about 39% of those veterans serve Iraq or Afghanistan. And, you know, historically, veterans have really been underserved in our rural areas of the country regarding VA services. And so, you know, there's a lot of factors that contributed to that. You know, the long distance travel to VA medical centers for care, the fact that they have no health insurance, and there was very little specialized medical care for them to take it. The other issues, and many of you, I'm sure, are aware of this, is the limited amount of providers and the care that they can provide. And looking at this population of veterans, about half of them we do know suffer from some chronic health condition that requires good medical care. And of those, there's additional issues that they're facing, such as traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. So the the efforts of the Office of Rural Health have been to focus on expanding community-based access to care for these veterans and to partner with community non-VA providers such as yourself to provide telemedicine and other technology for these veterans in these rural areas, and then lastly, to recruit and train more providers into these rural areas of the country. If you go on to slide 10, then, you can see that this is the web link that takes you now to the VHA Office of Rural Health, and this is the home page. And over on the left-hand column here, there is an option clear. It's the second from the bottom, and it says Contact Us. And when you click on that, it takes you into the next slide, which is slide 11. And this is what you see on the website now. And it gives you a lot of good information here. It actually has arrows pointing to the three regional offices now, rural health regional offices that the VA launched actually back in 2008. And there's like a eastern region, central region, and western region of these regional offices. And the eastern regions are located in Gainesville, Florida, Togus, Maine, and White River Junction, New York. And then the central region is in our vision, which is Iowa City, Iowa, in the eastern part of Iowa. And then the western region has a regional office in center, I should say, in Salt Lake City. And these regional offices are kind of, if you can envision them, as field-based research labs, and their focus is to understand and address those rural needs of veterans in the rural. And they're also, like I said, involved in the research, and their intent is to implement and evaluate new innovative practices that can be expanded throughout the VA. And then there's another level, and that is at the VISN level. So each VISN throughout the United States has what they call a VISN Rural Consultant. And those can be found on this website. If you focus kind of in the middle of the page above the map, you see where it says Staff Biographies, and under there, there are three options. And the bottom middle option is called VISN Rural Consultants, and when you click on that, you're going to be able to pull up the rural consultant for each of the states that would be, you know, pertain to your area, in case you would like to get a hold of that VISN consultant in your state or in your area. Now, Kathleen DeJacques McBride is the consultant for VISN 23 that are in the states in our region. I don't know if any of you have an interest in contacting her. You can either go on the website or 7559. So hopefully that will be some good information for you to browse through that website and take a look at what options and what activities are going on within the VA regarding the rural health initiative. So that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions for me before I turn it over to Caroline?
Just a reminder, Caroline, if your line is muted, to please press star pound, and that will unmute your line.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
All right. I will keep going then, and then if anybody has any questions for the both of us, we'll take those at the end. My name is Caroline Schauer. I appreciate being able to be on the call today. We've really, really learned so much in collaboration with the National Rural Health Resource Center. And so we want to explain a little bit about some of the partnership activities that we have been able to bring home on a more practical level. Part of this is a national movement, and part of it is bringing it down to a state and then down to a regional and specific facility level. So the We Honor Veterans, Creating a Veteran-Centric Culture, is a campaign that's being sponsored by jointly the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization and the VA. And so people say, well, what is veteran-centric? It's very easily translatable into patient-centered care, which is exactly what we want to do. When we want to do the right thing, we want to look at what's best for the veteran. And that's really what we try to focus on. When I came to the VA about 3 years ago, I came from private sector and had worked with freestanding hospice, and we had contracts in urban hospitals, rural hospitals, critical access hospitals, and nursing homes throughout the North Dakota and Minnesota territory. And when I came to the VA, hospice and palliative care was a movement that had been initiated back when everybody else had kind of begun that hospice and palliative care movement, especially palliative care within hospital care. But what was lacking is the funds. And so on slide 14, 15, and 16, you'll see that there was some actual dollars put towards increasing hospice and palliative care throughout the VA. And I'm really pleased that Vision 23 actually approved funding for hospice and palliative care prior to receiving the national funds. And so Kelly was part of blazing the trail and leading the way. And this is something, again, it's very hard to do without some seed money. We're now looking at that money being, again, initial seed money and needing to sustain our programs and prove our worth. So, of course, that's always the challenge. But we feel that we've made a difference in the care that the veterans receive. On slide 16, first I'll go back to slide 15 and just explain that I am a program manager within Vision 23, and the other visions across the country all have corresponding program managers. Dr. George Ramirez is our clinical champion, or as we call him, our medical director for hospice and palliative care. Each visit across the U.S. also has a clinical champion. We then also have teams, interdisciplinary teams, at every single VA facility, which was, again, a very, very big feat to really pull off. And in some facilities across the country are still lagging behind. They still aren't quite up to speed. In Vision 23, we're really pleased with the success of our teams and the work that they've been able to do, because without a team doing the patient care, really all of this is just talk. So again, we're looking at slide 16. What else was provided? Leadership training. So as leaders of our regions, we received training, but then we also had expertise and one-on-one training provided to each of our facility teams to teach them how to be effective, how to collaborate, how to work with other disciplines within their facilities. EPIC is end-of-life care training that was originally designed for physicians. Now it's opened up to all disciplines. They actually had a collaborative where they got together with EPIC and created EPIC for Veterans. And that has been offered to quite a few of our team members who have been able to go to the national training. There's palliative care nursing assistant program training where it's a train-the-trainer. So we've got a big movement to try to get all our nurse aides trained in hospice and palliative care. And that's throughout all of our medical facilities, both acute care and the nursing homes. And then there's ELNIC. And, again, that's a nursing component of end-of-life care. And that also has been redesigned for veterans. So that was a huge commitment for the VA to make, and we are still in the last phases of that training with our teams. The goal is that our teams will take this information back to the medical facilities, and again, it'll be train the trainer. We're really looking at infiltrating this care throughout the model of care, and so that the VA recognizes that there are palliative options and approaches in many cases of care. Slide 18 shows you one example that through our team's efforts, we've been able to make a statistical difference. And the lines, the top line, it represents ICU deaths. One thing that was noted nationally is that there was a huge number of our patients dying in ICU, and we knew that probably wasn't the best place for them, especially if they hadn't been offered any other option. And so our teams aggressively set out to work with their ICUs and then work at identifying those patients before they went to ICU. The second line, and you'll see down below, it says Hospice TS96. And that is, you know, when I came to the VA, I had to learn a whole new federal payment system. And that's part of, I think, the barriers and some of the miscommunication that occurs between private sector and the VA, because, you know, I knew the hospice Medicare benefit forward and backwards, and I also knew enough about the nursing home regulations and admitting criteria for hospitals, and it's like none of that translates over to the VA, or very little of it. It's similar, but it doesn't relate apples to apples. So that's part of what we're trying to come together as a community with, and we're trying to connect the dots. Slide 19 is called Promise, and there is a national NHPCO, National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, bereaved family survey that hospices are able to participate in. What the VA has implemented is a mandatory survey very similar to that, but a little bit different. It is like a quality survey that most hospitals would do, but the VA recognized that in the hospital surveys that they were doing, the patients who were discharged were the ones that were surveyed. So nobody ever got to hear the results from somebody who had actually died in the facility. So they started targeting this particular group. And so right now, across the nation, systematically, we submit to the Promise Center, which is a contracted facility that's helping us through the University of Pennsylvania. And they contact the family members of every single person that dies within the VA, whether or not they've had contact with hospice and palliative care or not. And then they ask that family member if they'd be willing to participate in a brief survey. Those results are then brought back to us, and they've been very eye-opening. And what we've really been determined to do is base our quality on the results that come to us, because that's family's perspective of the care that their loved one received. So again, we're looking at increasing quality as well as the availability and quantity of care that's offered. So in slide 20, you can see again, the goal is to disseminate care and improve outcomes. On slide 21, I outlined a little bit our goals in Vision 23. I think they're very, very similar to goals that you may see in community hospice and palliative care programs. But again, recognizing the fact, I know for a fact, coming from the private sector, we would say, oh, we have to send somebody to the VA. Oh, no, they won't get very good care, because that was the essence of what people believed happened at the VA. And coming to the VA, I have been so very impressed with the quality of care, with the resources available to care for the veterans. And it's one of the missions of the VA to be able to communicate effectively with other care organizations. We certainly can't care for veterans by ourselves. And that's the other thing, is we've recognized that we do the best care when we collaborate with others. And that's truly our goal. So again, we're looking at basic goals as we establish partnerships, looking at particularly community partnerships with hospices, but expanding that to nursing homes and rural hospitals, critical access hospitals. Going on to slide number 23, the nuts and bolts of this campaign can be found really in this website, wehonorveterans.org, and the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization actually devoted time and resources to help get this website up and running. And so what it means is that there is a campaign that involves hospice and palliative care teams working through levels of commitment, meaning they're going to learn more about veterans. They're going to learn more about what veterans can qualify for. One of the issues that hospice providers face, if they're utilizing Medicare and sometimes Medicaid and other insurers, is that under the Medicare benefit, it's very clear that with the per diem payment that hospices receive, they're really to provide all the care that that patient needs, which is kind of an old, outdated reimbursement system from the 80s, but it still exists today. And we know that families sometimes struggle with their caregiving needs. What we have been able to do and have been blessed to be able to do from central office on down, we've been able to offer our veterans and their families additional resources above and beyond the Medicare home benefit, which is a tremendous plus. And so in working with these hospices, we are able to extend a hand of help and say, how can we help you in caring for this particular veteran? We've had hospices that have been able to inform veterans about the VA benefits, and the veterans have never enrolled. And so they said, I had no idea that this was available to me. So that's really part of what we're looking at doing. As we go to slide 25, it is making certain that veterans know that there are services out there for them, and that hospices and other healthcare facilities are really interested in learning how to care for veterans. What do you do with a veteran with end-stage dementia who's dying, who all of a sudden starts talking about the trenches and the guns, and they start being fearful? And that's sometimes when hospices call us and say, what are we supposed to do? So we provide training on PTSD and helping our veterans through these trying times that they oftentimes experience for the first time at end of life. So again, there's specific things that we feel that we're able to offer. I think I'm going to conclude with that. Again, the rest is just summaries. But slide 28 is really an invitation to how can we partner with more than just community hospices. And I'm pleased that we have a call with the national leaders of the We Honor Veterans campaign next week to discuss this very issue about the need to be able to open up the arms a little bit wider to be able to invite other care providers to join in these efforts. Questions or comments?
Are there any questions for Kelly or Caroline? Okay, well, thank you to all of our speakers for being here today to share their updates and information and education with the group. We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to inform all of us. And thank you to all of the listeners today for participating in the call. If you do have any questions that come up, feel free to email TASK, and you will be sent an electronic email survey through SurveyMonkey shortly after the call for your feedback and evaluation on the call. So please do take the time to complete that. It's really important to us and the quality of these calls. Thank you all again, and we look forward to hearing from you soon. Bye-bye.